are listening to a free version of Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support this show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
It is August. It is Thursday, August 10th, 2017. My name is Sam Steeder. This is the four-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, Gilad Edelman, editor of the Washington Monthly. Trump's doing nothing but methodically destroying our government. And meanwhile, speaking of the U.S. government, it's split over North Korea. Not to mention, we don't have a South Korean ambassador or two key aides at the UN.
We're nuking it. We're doing it. But before that, can Mitt be ambassador to South Korea?
Trump lawyers mad about the Manafort rage. Meanwhile, Republicans at war with each other and hope to come together to crash the debt ceiling. Deportation horror stories keep coming. And Indiana sued for really a stunning case of voter suppression of African American and Latinos. All this and more on today's program, ladies and gentlemen. We're still here. We're still here. I mean, all the pieces now that we're seeing coming out about North Korea suggest that really, and this is something I think more or less we said over the past couple of days, is that and maybe even in the past when we had Heather Hurlburt on, I think that became months ago, prior to Trump being inaugurated, is that the wild card here is not Kim Jong-un. The wild card here is Donald Trump. That seems to be the only irrational player in this whole mix. And I think the only good news I can tell you is that the North Koreans seem to be aware of that. This is a statement from General Kim Rok-gum. He is the commander of the strategic force of the Korean People's Army. This is what he had to say in response to Donald Trump.
U.S. president at a Gulf Links again let out a load of nonsense about fire and fury, failing to grasp the ongoing grave situation. Statement adds, it seems that he has not yet understood the statement. Sound dialogue is not possible with such a guy, bereft of reason, and only absolute force can work on him.
That, of course, was Wolf Blitzer from CNN. But I think probably even the most sober of analysts and experts on foreign policy would probably agree. And it certainly appears that those in the Trump administration also agree, more or less, with Rex Tillerson saying, don't take it too seriously. And
literally like Syria. It was actually, it was opposite day. We'd like to negotiate with you.
And so that's where we are, folks. I mean, the real concern is that there's an irrational leader of this country. We also have a poll, and maybe I'll get to that later in the fun half. But half of Republicans are okay with postponing the 2020 election. But to be fair to them, it's to find out, all this problem with all the fraudulent voters.
Yeah.
The 3 to 4 million
what the hell's going
of fraudulent
on.
Voters. Of course, the amazing thing is they also, half of them, maybe it's not the same subset, also believe that Donald Trump won the popular vote. Well, it's only surprising insofar as if it's the same people, then they think that he won with 3 or 4 million fraudulent votes.
Or,
but number schmumbers, yeah. Don't get caught up in that.
They are laughing at us. Everyone will tell you we should have bombed Seoul a long time ago in a certain sense.
Folks, I figured something out. I think Saul has figured this out too. The Casper is an obsessively engineered mattress at a shockingly fair price. I don't think Saul cares about the price because he's four. But I think he realizes it's the best mattress we have in the house. It's got supportive memory foam, creates what apparently is an award-winning sleep surface. Has just the right sink, just the right bounce. Here's the best thing. You can try Casper for 100 nights risk-free in your own home. They ship it in a box. It pops out. If they don't love it, they'll come and pick it up and refund you everything. It's free shipping and returns to U.S. and Canada with over 20,000 reviews, an average of 4.8 stars. It's quickly becoming the internet's favorite mattress. Now, I could tell Saul, like, you have a Casper mattress. It wouldn't mean anything to him. He knows it's a great mattress. In fact, this is how I know he knows. He sleeps in the bed, which is, like I've said many times before, the most comfortable mattress in the house. Nikki and I fall asleep on it. Probably 80% of the time we lie down with him. So we're going to be here for 3 minutes, and that's it, and then we fall asleep. But when he has to pee, he gets out of his bed and comes into our bed and pees in our bed. Never pees in his own bed.
He's a smart kid.
Smart kid. It's the most comfortable one mattress in our house, except for if you've got to take a pee in it, and then he gets up and he pees in our
bed. Does he look at you while he's doing it? Like, oh, what happened? Yeah, I did it again.
Yeah. That's when a smile comes across.
Just stares you down.
Can
smirks.
You stop me? I don't think so. You can get $50 off any mattress purchase by going to Casper.com/majority and using the offer code majority. You can also try P in Sam's bed, but I don't think that's going to work. It's offer code majority. Casper.com/majority. Terms and conditions apply. All right, we're going to take a quick break. When we come back, Jalad Edelman, who's written a piece on Trump's plan to make government slower, costlier, and more dysfunctional. And spoiler alert, it's also a longtime Republican plan. We'll be right back. We are back. Sam Seder on the Majority Report on the phone. Jalad Edelman, he is an editor with the Washington Monthly and the author of the plan of the piece entitled Trump's Plan to Make Government Slower, Costlier, and More Dysfunctional. Jalad, welcome to the program.
Glad to be here.
So and you make this clear in your piece. I mean, this is really a long-term project by the Republicans and conservatives. There does seem to be it's fairly unique insofar as it seems to be one of the few things that they can actually execute. I mean, aside from increasing deportation orders, but this seems to be the golden chalice, and particularly, Steve Bannon, this is a big part of his project as well.
Absolutely. I mean, deconstructing the administrative state is one of his mottos. But to go back to your comment about the long-running conservative campaign, that's true. But there's a bipartisan element to this story as well. The size of the federal workforce hasn't grown in 50 years. I mean, it's gone up and down a little bit here and there. But basically, there were 2.1 million federal employees in 1966, and that's basically the number we have today. Even though the population has grown by 50% or more, the federal budget has quadrupled or more. So you'd think, given that, the size of the federal workforce would grow. But under both Republican and Democratic government control, it hasn't. The difference, I think, is that for on the right, shrinking government is a kind of a fixed ideological commitment, whereas on the left, it's more of something that is tolerated.
And we should also note, too, I mean, and maybe this is a broader story than the federal government, but the last recovery was the first, I think, in the last four or five, including one under Reagan, Bush 1, Clinton, and Bush 2, where the size of government in terms of the hires has not increased in coming out of a recession. I mean, I think we're you know, just, and that may be more of a story of state government as well. But the trend has certainly been in keeping that workforce, I guess, suppressed. And, you know, part of it, I guess, we can see also in Bill Clinton saying, you know, the era of big government is over, whatever that means.
Exactly, Sam. And the Clinton administration had this initiative. Some of your listeners may remember a little bit before my time, but it was called Reinventing Government, headed by Al Gore. And they actually did succeed in cutting a lot of, like, 400,000 jobs. A lot of that, though, was thanks to the end of the Cold War. So a lot of those jobs, the bulk of those jobs, were in defense. But here's the thing. The contractor workforce grew all throughout the 90s. And that's the big point. One of the big points of my story is that when I say the size of the federal workforce hasn't grown, that's official federal employees. But since everything else has grown, the budget, the size and scope of federal programs, the population, somebody's got to do all that work. And that work is increasingly done by private contractors.
So we're at a federal government, I guess, number of employees that has existed since prior to there being an EPA, prior to there being a Department of Homeland Security, prior to there being a FEMA. Medicare and Medicaid had just occurred, I guess, and so they were, at the very least, we were ramping up for that. So we flatlined, and the big story is that we're just privatizing the function of government to a large extent.
Absolutely. And yeah, Medicare and Medicaid launched in 1966, something like that. So basically, and now they're a huge percentage of the federal budget, like a quarter. So basically, we have the same number of employees as we did when those didn't exist. A lot of people, you know, when I think a lot of people, when they hear contractors, the first thing they think of is Iraq and Afghanistan, because the media have done a pretty good job publicizing the reliance on private contractors to fight those wars. But what I don't think people appreciate as much, and I did not appreciate as much until I started working on this piece, is that every part of the federal government, not just the military, relies heavily on contractors to do the exact same kind of work that federal employees do. So if you walk into, it's not just in D.C., most federal government employees are actually outside of D.C. So if you walk into, you know, like a Department of the Interior office in Utah, or you walk into a Social Security office in Chicago, you might see 10 people working there, but five of them might actually be private contractors.
I mean, I want to put a pin in that and come back to that, because that's sort of amazing. And we your piece really focuses on the cost of those two people who are sitting in that Social Security Administration window, who may be doing the exact same thing, and the relative cost to taxpayers, and frankly, the efficiencies involved in it. I didn't even realize that, you know, you had a figure in here about Afghanistan, that we have about, and this was in 2016, we have more now, I think, but we had 10,000 uniformed soldiers approximately, and close to 30,000 contractors there. If Eric Prince had his way, we'd have more. But yes, and I have to say also, before we get to sort of dig into a little bit more about the contractors across the federal government, this is why when Obama, sadly, late in his administration, started to put requirements in terms of like wages and whatnot on federal contractors doing business with the U.S. government, why it was so relevant, because there were so many of them that you're actually impacting the workforce in a significant way.
Yeah, absolutely. And the Obama administration tried to rein a lot of this stuff in. The best sense that I got from my reporting is that the results were mixed at best. It's hard. It's a hard problem, because once so much of the work that the government, of the essential work of the government, is done by these contractors, it becomes hard to wean yourself off, especially because this is big business. When you hire more federal employees, that's not a new constituency that's going to give you a ton of campaign donations in the same way as you hand out a juicy contract. All of a sudden, there's somebody beholden to you. So it's really tough to wind it back.
And we don't even know how many contractors there are, do we?
No, that is the weirdest thing by far that I found out. I spent so much time just trying to get the numbers straight. So I talked, there's a handful of people who really study this stuff. And one of them is this guy named Paul Light, who's a professor at NYU. And he puts out these reports on what he calls the true size of government. And as he told, basically, no one knows for sure exactly how many contractors the federal government employs. Even the CBO has said, has released reports where they say, unfortunately, no good numbers exist for how many contractors, meaning even the government doesn't know. Because although agencies have set numbers of what are called full-time equivalents, basically employees, they don't have to log the number of contractors that they're paying. So Paul Light, basically uses the available data to make his best estimate. And his best estimate is that there are about 3.7 million contractors employed by the government. So that's, compared to about 2 million direct federal employees, excluding the Postal Service.
That's
so it's a huge
crazy.
Number.
It's crazy that we don't know the number.
It's totally bananas.
How is it that we don't? I mean, is this just sort of like a slight oversight, or has there been bills that introduced that would say like, hey, you've got to, when you're paying for contractors, where you can't just put it into some type of like broad line item of like, we're getting this done.
Right. Because that's basically how they get to do it. That's right. I'm not sure how much legislation has been proposed to try to fix this problem, but as you suggest, these are fundamentally legislative problems. Like this, Congress is the real culprit in all of this, because if Congress wanted to pass a law that said you have to give us a detailed accounting of how many contractors are on your payroll, they could do it, but they haven't.
I suppose that's because, and you get to this at the end of your piece, I don't want to get ahead of ourselves, but that type of transparency would influence the debate. But before we get there, let's talk about the myths that have built up around private contractors. And some of this, there was a big push, and I feel like this was probably like 5 years ago, by the Grover Norquist types, to basically say like, why should public sector workers get pensions when you don't? Why should they be, and they're overpaid as it is, so they're costing the government more. Talk about that that sort of sleight of hand that's involved in that formulation.
Yeah, there's so much mythology around this whole thing. Just to go back one step, this whole idea about cutting the size of government, right? This plays really well politically. Everybody knows intuitively that the federal government is too big, and we waste so much money. And as I've already mentioned, it actually hasn't grown for 50 years, so it's clearly too small, not too big.
Right.
But also, it's also not that expensive. The entire cost of salaries and benefits of the federal civilian workforce, excluding the postal service, is like $280 billion or something around there. The federal budget is $4 trillion. I mean, even if you got rid of every federal employee, you're saving less than 10% of what the government spends. It's just not that significant. So then to go to the Grover Norquist thing, right? One of the myths about contracting out the functions of government is that it's going to save money. And one thing that people point to is exactly what you mentioned, this idea that federal workers are obviously overpaid. The Heritage Foundation, for instance, put out a report maybe 6 years ago that compared federal employees to private sector employees, you know, doing comparable work. And it found that when you look at salaries and benefits, federal employees make way more money. So obviously we're wasting money on them. Here's the problem with that. When you hire a contractor, you're not just paying that person directly. You're paying the company, and the company is turning a profit. So you're paying for the company's profit margin, and you're paying for the management of that company to make its enormous salaries. So the cost, forget what someone in government makes versus what someone in the private sector makes. What you have to compare is what a government contractor makes to what a government employee makes. The Project on Government Oversight has done the best work on this. It's hard because, as you said, there's not a lot of good data, but they looked at the categories where there was pretty good data. And they looked at 32 or 33 categories, and they found that in all but two of them, it cost the federal government more to hire a private contractor to do a job than to hire a direct employee, even when you include benefits and pensions and stuff like that.
Right, because the government doesn't need to make a profit or provide shareholders dividends or to provide, all the bennies to rebuild the apparatus to make sure that that person shows up at work that day.
Right. Right. There's all this overhead that you've got to pay. Even before you get to the profit margin, when you're hiring a contractor, you're paying for the overhead at that company. And then you add in the profit. I mean, the CEOs of these contractors make $3 or $4 million a year. So that money's got to come from somewhere. So then the idea that you're saving money on contractors, there's a couple other wrinkles to it. The other idea is, well, you know, private sector competition, right? We make them compete against each other and offer an aggressive bid, and we'll save money that way. The problem is that there's not actually that much competition. There's a lot of industry consolidation. There's a lot of these cozy deals. So something like half of all contracts awarded by the Defense Department had only one bidder. Well, if there's only one bidder, you're not getting competition to drive the price down.
And do we have a sense of, like, what kind of lobbying is involved in this? I mean, obviously, the Congress doesn't make the decision as to who's getting awarded a contract. But I presume if I am a big player in a specific space, right? Let's say I provide, refreshments or temp workers or sanitation workers or something like that. Just lobbying to get these contracts and to privatize some of the functions of the federal government, I know I'm putting myself, or maybe an industry group does it, so that this money starts to flow into my coffers. Is there lobbying involved in this?
Oh, definitely. It's huge. And that really should be my next article. I mean, I address it only glancingly in my piece because right. I had so much else to explain. One thing that I do mention in the piece is that political scientist Lee Drutman did a study in 2011 or thereabouts looking at the relationship between campaign contributions and contracts. And he found, not at all surprisingly, that there was a positive correlation. The contractors who gave more in campaign donations tended to get awarded more contracts. The campaign finance law around contracting is pretty bizarre. There's a ban on recipients of federal contractors making campaign contributions, but it only applies to individuals or sole proprietors. In other words, not the people that we care about. If you're a guy who's renting out his backhoe, and you get a deal from the federal government, you're not allowed to make a campaign contribution. But if you're a multi-billion-dollar corporation, you could set up a political action committee, can make donations. So the campaign finance laws absolutely do not address the places where we would actually care about.
And again, I would imagine that part of that is not just a function of like, I'm going to give you campaign contributions. You steer this contract to me. It's I'm going to give you campaign contributions to privatize stuff. And I just happen to be, I know based upon what my standing is within a certain industry that I am primed to do that, to be able to get that contract over my competitors.
Exactly. That's exactly right.
I mean, I love the piece where you and this gets that that thing you said at the beginning about Social Security administrations, that even the contract specialists, the government hires contractors to dole out contracts, and they are more expensive than the government people who issue the contracts to the people to hand out the contracts.
Yeah, that kind of blew my mind.
Go ahead.
Well, one of the places where the keeping the size of the federal workforce artificially low really hurts us is actually managing contracts. That's something that I heard over and over again. I talked to dozens of people for this article inside and outside government in contracting, even people on the contracting side, said, yeah, when you don't have enough people just to manage the contracts, the government is going to end up wasting a lot of money.
So there's a tremendous amount of there's a lack of accountability. And I mean, and that follows the same dynamic as we see with the IRS, which you make a point of. I mean, you know, the IRS, I guess I can see the ideological reasons that the conservatives have. And you know, perhaps the Democrats, although I think that's happened less under Democratic Congresses, to short the IRS funding. I mean, the staff has been cut by almost 20% in the last 8 years. It's crazy.
And according to the Treasury Department, so there's a $450 billion tax gap, meaning taxes that aren't getting collected. And the Treasury Department itself has said every dollar that you spend on staffing up for enforcement would bring back $6 in increased revenue.
I mean, there's a conscious effort, obviously, not to get those $6 for every one that you spend. But I think also, you know, this to me is there's a similar dynamic here, it seems to me, as we see with the deficit hawkery whenever that comes up, in that it really is not about the deficit. It's not about the budget. And I hope people don't misunderstand. I don't think it necessarily should be. But that it's not about that. It's actually about trying to cut things like Social Security or Medicare. And in this instance, it's not about the size of government by measuring it in any rational sense. It's about privatization, about giving corporations, really sending U.S. tax dollars to corporations directly.
Yeah, and the more you star, it's this classic star of the beast, right? I mean, the more you refuse to let critical agencies like the Social Security Administration staff up to do their jobs, the easier your case becomes for saying, look how bad they are, we should just privatize this.
Talk about the, go ahead. I'm sorry. Go ahead.
No, go ahead, Sam.
Well, I want to talk about the GAO's high risk agencies, just so we get a sense of where this is basically impacting that dynamic that you're talking about. We will, I know this has been a sort of a long-term plan to do this with the Social Security Administration. And we also sort of see some version of this with the post office, even though the post office doesn't get funds directly from the U.S. government. But talk about the high-risk agencies, because I think this is where we see that dynamic play out.
Right. So the Government Accountability Office every year puts out a list of its high-risk agencies, places where they think there's a great risk of them basically not being able to do their mission. And there's a pretty notable relationship between agencies that are more heavily dependent on contractors and agencies that show up on that high-risk list. One of the agencies that's always on that list is CMS, Center for Medicaid and Medicare Services, which is responsible for something like a quarter of the federal budget and is tiny. Each employee there is responsible for almost $200 million in federal spending every year, some ridiculous number. And if you look at something like the Social Security Administration, there's the backlog for appeals can be a year or 2 years. The time you wait to have an appeal resolved.
That's for disabilities.
Right. And you might, as you say, there's no way to understand why Republicans or conservatives would want that outcome other than to then justify the case of, well, we better just privatize the whole thing because obviously it's failing. Well, yeah, it's failing because you're strangling it.
And we should also add, I mean, you can also measure this in terms of efficacy. You note that the Centers for Medical Medicaid Services employ 6,000 employees and 14,000 contractors. That the quality of the contractors' work is not necessarily better. And in many instances, we see it's worse, particularly when you're talking about like security lapses and technological lapses. I mean, it seems to me it's true. You get the best of the both worlds from a sort of a Grover Norquist worldview, because you're spending these dollars on corporate America and then you're blaming the government for the failures of these institutions when there's a huge data leak or something.
Yeah, that's a super important point. When there's a data big hack or some big screw up, it's not the contractors who get hauled in to testify before the Senate. It's the people from the agencies. The head of FEMA after the Hurricane Katrina disaster was rightfully scapegoated is the wrong word because he deserved blame, but FEMA is one of the most heavily contractor dependent agencies. Yep. By the way, I don't want to paint with too broad a brush. It's not like contractors are evil or they're always horrible at their jobs or anything like that. I mean, they're people. They're basically interchangeable with government employees in a lot of cases. I live in Washington, D.C., so I hang out with contractors. It's not like they're bad people or they're incompetent or anything like that. It's just that the federal government has been kept too small to properly manage them.
Well, you raise Katrina as an example, and I specifically remember one of the reasons why the buses never showed up in New Orleans at that time was because the bus contract was subcontracted three different times. And it was a contractor who was responsible to get the contract for the buses that then subcontracted it out to someone else. And the bottom line is this, is that their job number one is profits. And so they did not want to move the buses out of the parking lots where it was, I don't know, 70, 120 miles away or wherever those buses were at the time. It escapes me now, but they didn't want to put them into the position because that would have cost them money. And in the event that they weren't needed, they would have had to eat part of what would have been the profits from those contracts. And so their job number one is to maximize profits and still get the job done. But there is a percentage in there that means that we're not willing to waste money. I mean, we saw it in the city, frankly, when it comes to snow removal. you know, you can contract it out to private contractors, but the bottom line is they're not necessarily going to be ready because it costs them money. And that's the thing, is that for them, it's a wasted profit opportunity. There may be a certain amount of waste involved in this in terms of from the government, U.S. government's perspective. But the bottom line is that's what you got to spend to make sure the job happens, even in those times where it's not necessarily a profitable business. Right. I mean, it's the same.
Exactly.
Same dynamic with the post office. I don't want to go to rural America to deliver mail unless, you know, unless it's like it's a government service. Because it's just not going to be as profitable, at least for 42 cents or 44 cents. Talk about the rollout of the Obamacare website that was that nearly sunk that entire. Go ahead.
Right, the healthcare.gov. I mean, I think there were a lot of moving parts there, but one of the. When folks went and did postmortems on that, one of the contributing factors was just the insufficient contractor management. That was a huge project that had a lot of different contractors working on it. And one of the critical factors behind the botched rollout was it just didn't have enough folks within CMS to be properly managing all those contractors. And, you know, something that a guy told me who is a contractor, a cybersecurity guy within Homeland Security, but he's also done some work for Health and Human Services, which is where healthcare.gov was housed. His take on it was, and this didn't even make it into the article, but his take was that when you hire all these different contractors to do little pieces of the job, they're not taking a big picture view. In other words, if they're just doing one little part of healthcare.gov, Their North Star is not making sure healthcare.gov works. It's just making sure that they deliver to within the four corners of their contract. And so his perspective was part of the problem was you had all these different contractors kind of working in silos that didn't have necessarily, because they're not part of the institution of government, they didn't necessarily have loyalty to the overall mission. And that is one factor that leads to more screw-ups.
And you know, it's not to suggest that you want the government to have the ability to build a one-off website, as it were, or, you know, and website is making it a little bit, is being a little facile with what was involved in it. But you want to have the oversight. You want to have people managing the project, and you want to have staff to do that. The other dilemma that you talk about is that as contracting and as, you know, the Trump administration puts in these plans to freeze hiring and to not replace those federal workers who leave, is that as it gets filled by contractors, you're losing institutional memory in these agencies.
Yeah, the federal government is crazy old. I mean, going back a decade or more, people have been sounding the alarm on this. In some agencies, like the IRS, half of employees are 50 years or older. And the problem is not that being old is not the problem. The problem is that there's huge percentages of federal agencies that are eligible to retire. And through decades of imposing these hiring freezes means that there's not this pipeline of talent coming up behind them. And we're already seeing, as part of these efforts, the Trump administration's efforts to get agencies to downsize, the Social Security Administration, it was recently reported, is offering early retirement to something like one quarter of its workforce. If they all took that early retirement option, you know, imagine how little the Social Security Administration would be able to get done. And then when these people leave, so I talked to a guy who's an executive at a big contracting firm, and he was telling me that when he's dealing with the procurement officers in government, the people, in other words, who write the contract, there's a lot of people who have been there forever and really know what they're doing, but then behind them there's just these gaps in age cohorts where there should be people with, you know, mid-career, and they just don't exist because they were casualties of hiring freezes. And so he's frustrated because he's either dealing with people who are towards the end of their careers and very knowledgeable, or somebody who's really young and doesn't really know what they're doing and doesn't have necessarily somebody showing them the ropes, because there's these missing cohorts. And this was a guy who works at a contracting, a firm that gets most of its revenue from contracting. But he was complaining about the bad contracts that the government ends up getting into because of this lack of a talent pipeline.
So we have these sort of lost generations that probably coincide with hiring freezes, maybe time during the Bush administration, maybe that Al Gore initiative or whatnot, where you just don't have the consistency that you would want, right? I mean, this is theoretically going to continue. You don't want just one generation in there. So of the fixes that you suggest, I mean, the first is to tell this story. I mean, so that people understand just how much of the government is contracted out.
Right, and understand what bullshit it is when someone in the administration says the federal government is bloated, we need to cut it, that's draining the swamp. Just to understand that that's nonsense, and that when you talk about, if you're not actually going to reduce the scope of federal programs, you know, things like big expensive things like Medicare, Medicaid, Social Security, if you don't actually wind down those programs, which requires legislation, then the only thing that you're going to accomplish if you even succeed in reducing the workforce is to replace those federal employees with more expensive contractors.
And then you suggest some other fixes that are sort of like second order things, but that are almost the good government reforms. One is streamlining the process on how you fire, even. Just briefly touch on that.
Yeah, absolutely. So one thing that I was not surprised to hear was, you know, managers within government like hiring contractors because it's easier to get rid of them. It's hard to fire federal employees because there are several long overlapping appeals processes. So the Partnership for Public Service has a report suggesting that you take all those different types of appeals and at least consolidate them in one shop so it doesn't take over a year to get rid of somebody while their appeals work out. What I was surprised, though, is that what people talked about a lot more than the difficulty of firing federal employees was the difficulty in hiring them. And that's another reason, that's another incentive to hire contractors, because you can get them in next week. But if you want to hire employees, it can take a year or more. And briefly, the reasons are, one, there's this outdated hiring system that has not been a happy pairing with the internet. So federal law requires all federal jobs to be publicly posted. So what that means nowadays is they get posted on usajobs.com. The problem is that you end up getting hundreds or thousands of applications for every freaking job, even low-level ones, and it just takes forever to go through those applications. Then another problem is once you hire someone, if they need a security clearance, that can take another year. Whereas contracting firms will employ people who used to work in government who already have the security clearance. Mm. So it becomes very appealing. So if you want to actually, you know, and this is not some nefarious Republican plot. This is a legitimate criticism of, you know, the grinding bureaucracy of federal hiring. So if you want to make it possible to wean the government off of this contractor addiction, you got to fix how ridiculously long it takes to hire the right person for the job.
But that to me seems like second order stuff. The first one is creating, and you write about this, finding the political will. And it seems to me that has to be a larger project of making the American people understand and appreciate what the federal government does and fighting those myths that you talk about at the beginning of the piece.
Totally. Some kind of encouraging news on this front is that there was that poll by the House Majority PAC, the commissioned by the Congressional Democrats, the poll of white working class voters. This came out a couple weeks ago. One of the things they asked them about to see how it played was, you know, going after contractors, punishing contractors who are fraudulent or screw up their contracts, something like that. And it turns out that played really well among these, you know, the famous white working class voters who need to be brought back into the fold. So the reason that's encouraging is because it suggests that this is not just some like wonky good government thing that no one really cares about. It's something that could actually be effective as political messaging.
Jalad Edelman? Go ahead.
I was just going to say, if you don't get voters to care about it, then it's never going to go anywhere.
Jalad Edelman of the Washington Monthly. The piece is Trump's plan to make government slower, costlier, and more dysfunctional. We will link to it at majority.fm. Thanks so much for your time today. I really appreciate it.
Thanks for having me.
All right, folks. Going to head into the fun half, wherein we will play some audio clips. And just a reminder, this show is able to keep chugging day in, day out because of our members. And when you become a member at jointhemajorityreport.com, we say thank you by giving you extra content. Some people like to listen to the extra content. Some people don't. Some people like to listen exclusively to the extra content. They're like, I don't want to sit through a 30-minute interview about how contractors are, the whole myth around contractors are
Galad fraudulent. Seems like a nice boy, but that was very tense.
And so they just listen to the fun half.
The fun half.
Oh, we also...
That was too good.
We're going to play that again, right?
We have to play the one from yesterday again. I think that was so special. Do you have that?
Well, you have to. I don't think you forwarded me the. Was there another one?
Oh no, I forwarded. I was thinking the one from yesterday, just again.
All right, we'll play the one from yesterday again, but then we'll play the other new one. People keep submitting them. But yes, we need your support, folks. If you have the financial means, please join themajorityreport.com. Jointhemajorityreport.com. If you are someone who is going through a rough patch right now financially. And could use the extra content to listen to brighten your day. A lot of people, particularly in this era, more so, I think, you know, it reminds me a little bit of the Bush days where people were like, I was going insane. And I appreciate the being able to sort of an opportunity to laugh at it. If you're one of those folks who want to hear the fun half but don't have the financial means, send us an email at majorityreporters@gmail.com. Have a little bit of patience because I'm often behind on the emails, but we will hook you up. Also, justcoffee.coop, fair trade coffee, tea, or chocolate. Use the coupon code MAJORITY. We get 10% off of that great coffee. And if you buy your crap from Amazon, go to MajorityReportKickback.com. Click on the link. Buy your stuff via that link. I don't know. There might be some way that you can save it in your browser in some fashion or something. I don't know. I'm not familiar with the latest in browser technology. But if you do buy your stuff through there, buy it through our link. We get a kickback. Thus, MajorityReportKickback.com. But as they say, the greatest act of all is to become a member at JoinTheMajorityReport.com. All right, quick break. Into the fun half.
Which one are you playing here? The one I just
played. The one yesterday.
The one I just forwarded it to you again.
Okay. This is who gave us the
DJ Danerke.
DJ Danerke.
And what's so great is he answers your question in the track.
He answers my question?
You don't remember? Well, you'll hear in a second.
Well, then you will hear this, and then we'll go La Poupée and then go into the fun half.
No.
Here we go.
Boo.
You are in for it.
All right, folks. 646-257-3920. See you in the fun half.
Are you ready?
Who sent us this?
The
alpha males are back. Back, back, back. Boy is back. And the alpha males are back. Back.
Just as delicious as you could imagine.
The alpha males are back, 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 boy, back. And the alpha males are back, 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 back.
Just wanna degrade the white man.
Alpha males are back, back.
I
I take all of it in my throat.
Alpha males are back, 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 back.
Almost says what?
The alpha males are back, 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 back.
You are a madman.
Alpha males are back, back, back.
I am a total cunt.
That's so good. All right, we'll see you in the fun half.